I'm Karen Hart Glass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. It is April 30th, 2013. And I really want to say again, if you have any comments and questions to give me a call, now would be a great time because my next guest is not available at the moment, and I'm not sure if he will be joining us this half hour, but we will see if he does manage to connect with us. But in the meanwhile, I am here, and I'm going to be talking about my favorite subject, food, which I can do 24 hours a day. The number is 1-888-874-4888. I was not surprised at all with my last guest, to hear what he had to say about food. Now, this was clearly a very skilled cardiologist, and he saved many, many lives. And he wrote a very, very lovely, touching book with wonderful stories. And he experienced joy and heartache and had people literally die in his arms from time to time, some of them people that were very dear to him. But the thing that he clearly does not know enough about is food. And the question is, how do we have this disconnect with people who truly care about health and truly care about saving lives and yet don't know about something that is so essential? Now, part of it, of course, has to do with all the information that doctors need to learn when they're in school. And as technology becomes more complicated and more specialized, there's far more information that they need to learn. So I don't necessarily want to put the blame on them, but we do have an obligation. We have an obligation as patients whenever we see our doctors to let them know what our expectations are. For example, I don't go to the doctor very often, but when I was getting a full checkup, my primary care physician wanted me to go to a cardiologist and have a stress test and a variety of other things. And I had this conversation with this cardiologist. He was young, and I kept saying to him, "Why aren't you talking more to me about food?" And he pointed a checklist to me of the items that he talks about with all of his patients. And diet was either item one or two on the top, along with smoking. And he said he does mention it. But I felt that he didn't mention it enough. You know, you can say in a blink, well, you know, you really need to change your diet if you want to get well. It's more than that. It needs to be enforced that it is essential for health, quality of life, longevity. The patient needs to be responsible as well as the doctor. We can't just leave our life in someone else's hands. And I'm a big proponent of medical treatment for many, many things. Our technology is incredible, and there are so many things that we can take care of today with medical treatment. But we are such an essential part of it. And this one doctor that I was just talking to, he discusses in his book, we didn't go over it in detail when I interviewed him, but he did have heart disease. He did have a heart attack. He did have diabetes, and he needs to change his diet. It's that simple if he really wants to have excellent health. And many people today are promoting this Mediterranean diet. Now, the Mediterranean diet is better than the standard American diet of highly processed foods, but it's not the ideal. And I think we're at a point, 2013, the 21st century, where we don't know what the ideal diet is. I like to say that, but we're getting close to what can really give us quality of life for a very long time. And that needs to get more press. Okay, so we're doing it here at the Progressive Radio Network. I know there are other people on the Progressive Radio Network who don't agree with what I believe is the ideal diet. So there is a bit of confusion. I get that. But I think we agree on many, many things. Most of us who are passionate about nutrition agree about the power of plant foods. Dark leafy green vegetables are great for boosting the immune system, and raw nuts and seeds. There's a lot of studies now that talk about how they are very helpful with heart disease and creating a healthy body. as I mentioned before, I'm in Florida right now, and after premiering our Swingin' Gourmets show in California last week, I was really looking forward to relaxing here for a while in between giving talks. And on Wednesday, last Wednesday, I was in California, and I had a floater shower. Have you ever heard of that? Some people, who are very nearsighted see these floaters. They're like little amoebas that flash across the eyes. And on occasion, you might see a whole, I think of it as like a reversed Milky Way of black dots. Well, I had one of these swim across my eye. It just lasted a few minutes. It was really a concern to me, but I didn't think about it until I was here in Florida on Friday, and I actually went to the Eye Institute in Miami, an excellent, excellent place, because I was concerned that I might have a retinal tear or retinal detachment, which, if you don't take care of it, can lead to blindness. And this is where going to for medical treatment for something like this, where we have a lot of great technology, is so important. And then somebody recently told me that pineapple is excellent for taking care of floaters. I'm not sure if that's true or not, and if you have any other suggestions, I'm open to hearing about them. But now we're going to bring on my next guest. I'm so glad that he is with us. Harold Brown is the founder of Farmkind, and he is a character in the documentary Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home. He spent over half of his life in agriculture, growing up on a beef farm in Michigan and later working in the dairy industry. Harold has been involved in the behind-the-scenes operations of food production that uses animals. Today, Harold is an activist advocating for sustainable food production, social and environmental justice, animal rights, and peace through nonviolence. Harold Brown, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Well, thank you for having me, Karen.
Hi. You know, I know a little bit about your story. I've been to your website, and I've seen the Peaceable Kingdom. We have some stereotypes about farmers, and we see them in films from time to time. They're usually very calm, very quiet, peaceful people that have some kind of innate connection or a learned connection with the rhythms of life and the planet and plants and food. And I bring this up because then there's this kind of disconnect. How do some farmers end up raising animals and slaughtering them when they have what appears to be this deep understanding of the flow of life?
Well, it's just part of the indoctrination you go through as a child. In my case, the indoctrination started, you know, of course, with my parents, and, you know, this is what we do for food and for making a living, and then everything just kind of cascades upon that. The indoctrination was reinforced by my extended family, because I grew up basically on my grandparents' farm, and then the surrounding farms were my great uncles, and then, you know, the larger agricultural community that was around us, and then 4-H, church, FFA, and I went to a land grant college, which, you know, their land grants, if people don't know, are set up to teach farmers how to farm. And but I think the largest reinforcer I had to my indoctrination was television. Every time a commercial came on, every commercial break seemed to sell some food product, and all those food products had animals in them. So, you know, those of us who did that work, we figured, well, we're meeting a demand, we're feeding a hungry world, you know, we're doing good work.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's pretty deeply instilled, you know, in our culture.
But still, as a young person, you felt there was something not quite right?
Yeah, and every farm kid that raises farm animals feels that, too. It's, You get attached to the animals, and you know the first thing that you're taught is don't name them, because you know your parents and grandparents and so on understand that if you make too deep of a connection, you're not going to be able to kill them and eat them. So you don't name them. Then, I mean it actually happened to me when I was, oh golly, I must have been eight years old or so. My grandfather had bought at auction, had bought a dairy cow. We raised beef cows. We had Genghis. But he got this Holstein steer, and he thought, well, he's really big, and let's see how big he gets and so on. But being that he was a dairy cow, they used a Holstein, he was very gentle. And people may not know that dairy cattle have been selectively bred to be docile, so they're easy to handle and milk, where beef cattle are not. They can be very cantankerous, and they can be dangerous at times. So my brother and I got attached to this cow. We named him Max. And then one day we came home from school and went to do chores, and Max wasn't there. And we asked our grandfather, where'd Max go? And they said, well, we slaughtered him. And, we freaked out. But my grandfather, what he did is he took all the packages of meat and he took the wax pencil and he wrote Max on all the packages. Oh. And they went in one end of the freezer and, it was in the other rest of the freezer. And they just knew that, when we were going to have hamburger or steak or something, they just didn't grab Max when we were going to be eating. So, that might sound strange to people, but, it comes back to the question you had about farmers and their degree of compassion and the disconnect. Obviously my grandfather was very sensitive to, our emotional state and our connection to Max. But on the other hand, it wasn't a question of should I stop doing this altogether, but rather let's just mediate the situation right now and have Max labeled so that the boys don't eat him. And that's how we dealt with that. But I think, too, that one thing that a lot of people don't understand is that by and large, most farmers don't, especially even small farms, but in particularly large farms, they aren't connected with the transport and slaughter, even the auction of the animals. A lot of farmers are not part of that because they don't want to see it.
Yeah.
Or they know that it's an emotional place they don't want to go. I've known many farmers like that. They've never been to a slaughterhouse. They've never actually, I know some farmers have never actually killed and butchered an animal themselves on their own farm. They just let that to somebody else. Again, there's degrees to the disconnect, even among farmers. So it's, it's different for everybody, and everybody's on this journey at a different point. And, farmers do have a connection, I wouldn't say it's deeper. I would just say that it's different. And they don't want to make that connection, but sometimes it does happen. I've had this happen in my life. I'll share a real quick story. When they were showing Peaceful Kingdom, The Journey Home in Cleveland, it was 2 years ago now, it was a huge screening. There were 600 people at this screening. And it was during this legislative initiative in Ohio called Ohioans for Humane Farms. Well, evidently, Farm Bureau had contacted some dairy farmers in the state and told them, go see this animal rights film and, challenge them. Okay, well, after the film was over, there were, tons of people talking to us, and the director of the film and videographer, Jenny Stein, she brought this older gentleman over to me, and she says, well, this is a farmer, and he's asking me questions I can't answer. And I said, okay, and I got talking to him. I said, so what did you think of the film? And he looked and he says, well, I don't agree with, you know, a lot of the stuff that's in that film, but, and then he stopped short. And I said, well, did something in the film kind of, you know, speak to you? And he just kind of was looking off in the distance and thought. And then he just looked me square in the eye. He said, what the hell did we do to ourselves?
Oh.
And, you know, this is a guy who's got a huge dairy farm in central Ohio. And I was like, what got him was that the footage of the 4-H auction. And every kid who's ever raised livestock and taken animals to the fair, you know, via 4-H, that first year is the worst. Second year can be almost as bad, but you get desensitized along the way. But that first year is terrible because you spend a year raising a cow, a sheep, a pig, and they become literally
your best friend.
Yeah, they're a companion animal. I mean, they run to see you when you come home from school, and
yeah,
they follow you around. You know, they're just there by your side all the time. And you're grooming them, and you're feeding them, and you're taking care of them, and, you know, taking extra special care of them. And they appreciate that. I mean, they bond to you. And then at the end of the fair, you have to auction them off. And they're going either to a slaughterhouse or they're going to a breeder. And it's the only two places they'll go. And, you know, it's heartbreaking. But the thing is we, you know, the older we get, in particular, we tend to kind of disconnect from that and forget about it. We push it down. You know, we keep it bottled up inside. And then, you know, for this guy, that film, you know, opened that bottle for him. You know, it just, the genie was out again. And, you know, that's really what it's about, is getting these people to connect to their, you know, to get honest with themselves emotionally.
Well, that the 4-H concept to me has always been so twisted and one of the uglier sides of humanity. And what does it teach us? We develop a bond with an animal, and the animal has trust in us, and then we break that trust. And it probably leads to, it could lead to a long life of relationships without trust with humans, because we treat our animals horribly. We also treat each other horribly.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. It's part of the what I call the domestication paradigm, is that when we domesticated animals, and farm animals in particular, but also cats and dogs, we created this artificial relationship that put where human interests always trump animal interests in the long run.
I didn't know that. I know that animals have been bred over thousands of years, but I didn't realize that cows' characteristic of being docile was something that was bred into them. And well, I learned something new every day. It makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You got to be able to handle them. You got to be able to milk them. And so on, and it's, I mean, they can, well, and they're also taking that even further. It's, like one of the things I talk about occasionally is that people who are, championing, welfare reforms, you know, I tell them, I say, you know, be careful what you wish for, because if the only metric you have or the main metric you have, in your activism is the suffering of animals. Well, they're engineering animals now through selective breeding, but in particular with dairy cows, they used at the front end of it a bit of cloning technology to develop a Holstein cows, which are now showing up in the United States, which, as the researchers in England who developed these cows, they call them vegetable animals. Long story short, what they did is they used cloning technology, which they've become fairly successful at, but clones over second, third generation develop a lot of problems, and they're not viable, and it's really expensive. So what they do is within a generation, they through cloning, they'll hyper-express a particular characteristic and immediately take that genetic material and put it into a, a regular cow. And then considering that cows give birth every 9 months, have a 9-month pregnancy, within 2 to 3 years, they were able to hyper-express that characteristic in a stable conventional animal. And as the researchers put it, it was basically, they called them zombie cows because their frontal cortexes are non-operational. Mm-hmm. In other words, these are cows that are born basically like they've had a lobotomy done. And they're super easy to handle. And it's a win for everybody that's involved because for the farmers, they're easier to handle. People have probably heard stories about when you milk cows playing soothing music or classical music. My grandfather used to do that. He used to play classical music. The cows tend to relax more, and they give more milk, a little bit more milk. But the butterfat content goes up. The less stressed a cow is, the higher the butterfat content. And so you've got this where that plus, everything that's connected to the handling, raising, and using and milking of these cows is now you've taken stress out of it. So the farmers are getting a cow easier to handle. They're getting more milk. The dairy plants are getting milk that's got higher butterfat content, which means, better quality, quote-unquote, dairy products and more of certain things like butter and so on and premium ice creams. And then at the other end of the spectrum would be the welfare reform people, because now if your metric is suffering, then now you have an animal that can't suffer. So now you have a whole new ethical dilemma. What do you do with, how can you violate the interest of an animal that cannot suffer, that cannot, experience the world?
I don't know. It gives me chills. It makes me think of the movie Cloud Atlas, where they were breeding these young women to live for a year to work as a sales slave of sorts. Anyway, it's just very sci-fi and very creepy.
Agriculture, especially at this day and age, I've had one dairy professor in Vermont who basically, was very Ayn Randian about it. It was that, I said, he said, well, we can't treat these animals poorly. I said, why do you say that? He says, because we are the God.
Oh, gosh. Even though these animals are docile, they must feel pain.
Oh, they do. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. We just have a few more minutes left, and I wanted to just touch on, I was talking to a cardiologist in the first half of this show, and I know that you experienced some heart disease early in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And was that food related?
Oh, yeah. It was, my particular problem was high triglycerides, which I got from my father. He died from heart disease, as did my mother. But the thing for me was that with high triglycerides, it's when you put saturated fats and sugar together. Like ice cream is the bomb when it comes to triglycerides. And at the time, I was working in a dairy plant and we're making this stuff. And I was eating, my wife will swear to this, I would eat on average 3 gallons of ice cream a week or more.
Wow.
And I was just putting myself down a hole. And when I got injured at work, the doctor, our union doctor, he said, well, this is how you deal with it. And I said, how come the doctors who work on my dad over at University of Michigan, they can't figure this out? They said, well, that's because I'm an osteopath and I have more nutrition training than an MD. I go, wow. And that was my first step.
Well, Harold, thank you for joining me today and sharing your stories. They're really quite moving. And I'm so glad that you're on our side now and sharing your stories, because we need to be talking so much about this. And making the world a better place, and you certainly are doing your part. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the work you're doing, too.
Okay. And thank you for joining me again. Your website is farmkind.org, and people can find you there.
Yes.
And watch Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home, another great documentary that you are a featured character in. Right?
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks again for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. We've come to the end of this program today. And visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me emails at info@realmeals.org. And one more thing, have a very delicious week.